From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the spring of 2013, just outside the little panhandle of Texas, in a town called Dumas. It had been a rough stretch of years. Just a couple of days earlier, a writer named Seamus McGraw had visited the office of a Texas state climatologist named John Nielsen Gammon. In McGraw's book called Betting the Farm on a Drought, he writes the following of Nielsen Gammon, quote, "He was a man who has the unenviable task of having to consistently deliver bad news to farmers and ranchers, and I asked him for a prediction. He told me that the merciless drought that had been hammering the panhandle for years, punctuated only by sporadic, brief, and often violent rain, hail, and snowstorms, was likely to last as far into the future as he could peer," end quote. But McGraw wanted to know, what would he advise farmers to do about it? Well, Nielsen Gammon replied that he doesn't tell farmers what to do. He believes they're in a better position to take it all in and make their own decisions. And so McGraw took that idea up to the farm of a man named David Ford, who isn't sure whether he believes in climate change. And here was the fascinating part. It kind of doesn't matter, because Ford does believe in the drought, and he believes in his family's ability to deal with it. And here's where I'm going with this. Whether we like it or not, climate change remains a political debate, even if it's not exactly a scientific or reality debate. And McGraw heard from some people that, well, they just knew that Al Gore believed in it, so why should they? This week, Al Gore is back at the forefront of a climate conversation. His new film is called An Inconvenient Sequel, and it sparked a fascinating response. He has his admirers, of course. He has political enemies. But Gore also has some progressives wondering if he's the right messenger for the issue, given the human tendency to be tribal. Let's discuss all of that with our guests for this hour. And we're glad to have the author of the book, Betting the Farm on a Drought, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change. That's Seamus McGraw. Seamus, thanks for taking the time for the program. How are you? Oh, we lost him for a second. Are you there, Seamus? Go ahead, sir. Rob, we'll see if we can get him back there. Susan Spencer is the president of Rockspot. She's a former attendee of Al Gore's International Climate Educators Conference. At least that's how I describe it. What technically was it, by the way?
It was called a Climate Reality Project Training Seminar.
Okay, and that was back in 2014.
Yep.
In Australia.
Correct.
And it was a big deal for you, wasn't it?
It was a big deal for me. I was fully funded to go there. I was the only person from the U.S. who was accepted.
And was Al Gore there?
Yes, he was. He was there the entire time.
All right. So we got a lot to talk about with Susan about her experience there. And frankly, all the work she's done in the last 3 years, it feels like a decade since I met you there. It's a lot.
Yeah, there's been a lot crammed in a short period of time. I feel a sense of positive urgency.
There
so
you
I
go. And Linda Isaacson-Fidelli is a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Always nice to see you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us,
and,
Evan.
Yep, and Seamus McGraw, I think, is with us now. How are you, sir?
I'm here. I'm with you.
Thank you for taking the time, Seamus. I want to start with you, Seamus, just in terms of, you know, your thoughts on Al Gore as a central figure in the public conversation. And I ask that because, you know, in reading through some of your book, and again, the book is Betting the Farm on a Drought, you know, you're talking to people who are pretty culturally, politically conservative, that they might not want to jump online and say, yes, I believe in the science, but they have to deal with some of the effects of it. What did you hear about, you know, figures like Al Gore in those kinds of conversations?
I think to some degree Al Gore became a lightning rod specifically because of his political pedigree. When you talk to a guy like Bob Inglis, the former congressman from South Carolina, who has become, quite frankly, in the last few years, a real advocate for a conservative approach, stepping up and taking the lead, quite frankly, in terms of action on climate. He talks about the fact that, you know, in his days in Congress, the very fact that Al Gore was for it was the reason so many people were against it.
Seamus, can I jump in for 1 second, Seamus?
Sure.
I'm glad you bring up Bob Inglis. Let's listen. We've got a cut from one of his TEDx talks on this very subject. Think about how honest this is. This is a former member of Congress who is not, by the way, one of these members of Congress who's a Republican, but, you know, really is pretty liberal. I mean, he is a very conservative guy, even post-Congress career, but he has come around to say climate change is not only real, but it should be a cause for people of all political backgrounds. But this is Bob Inglis describing his life in Congress and climate change.
Had a very successful press conference one time, sacks of coal, wood for a fire burning, and We said, Al Gore is going to raise these poor people's energy prices here in the cold Greenville, South Carolina. Of course, not many people heat with coal or wood in Greenville, South Carolina. Some do. Very successful press conference. It was all based on ignorance for me. I had not looked into the facts at all. All I knew was that Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it. Because I represented perhaps the reddest district in the reddest state in the nation.
That's Bob Inglis. And so, Seamus, I think that's remarkably honest to hear somebody say something like that, but it also reveals just how strong of a pull Gore has in multiple directions in the public debate. Go ahead now.
I think there's no question about that, but I think it also reveals something else. Bob Inglis's conversion came not in the political form. It came in the personal one. Bob Inglis's position changed when he was challenged by his own kids, who said, you know what, Dad, I'll vote for you next time around, but you've got to turn around and recognize what's really happening. And I think to a very great extent, look, it is absolutely essential to have voices out there that appeal to what, quite frankly, is the in this country who are willing to accept without the idea that we're facing a serious challenge in terms of climate. But that doesn't get us to the numbers that we need in order to effect change. What gets us...
We lost Seamus for just a second. Hey, Seamus, let me just jump in. If you can hear me, Seamus, let me just jump in.
Politics into the personal.
Okay, and yeah, we'll just make sure we reestablish a connection with Seamus there. And I think he's making an important point here, Linda, which is that Bob Inglis gets a lot of attention now as a former member of Congress, but it was his own children who said, Dad, this is not what you say it is, and or at least please look into this. And sometimes it's that when we think about epistemology, how people form beliefs, sometimes it takes a personal connection to get there. How often do you experience that when you just simply have conversations here around Rochester about climate?
I think it always takes a personal connection. I mean, I think we see in so many different realms in our country at all levels that we're kind of to the point where facts don't matter. So yeah, it's always about the personal connection and your neighbor, your friend, your child, just like this example showed. And that's why it's so important for us to be able to explain to others why we care about this, why we care about anything when we're trying to influence.
And when you say it feels like sort of the facts don't matter, but have you had conversations with people who have come around in the same way that Bob Inglis did for whatever reason?
Yeah, I have. Absolutely. I have friends and family who I've spoken with who eventually came around. It doesn't happen right away. I think it also takes multiple conversations with multiple people that we respect to have an impact.
And do you also, for that reason, you're acknowledging it doesn't happen in one conversation, doesn't happen right away. Is there a danger that some well-intended people have of almost shutting things down, lampooning those who are doubtful or not accepting of it, pushing them away instead of trying to continue to keep the door open?
Well, absolutely. I think in our culture it's really common for us to we look to place blame, we look to glorify people, and it's also almost sometimes like Al Gore obviously being the perfect example today, where the person that you're speaking with is more important than the message. I would love it if we could somehow take our information in a way that's blind to the person who was giving it to us. In some instances.
Yeah, I want to ask our listeners directly. Did you see an inconvenient truth, and will you see an inconvenient sequel? How did it impact you and your, I would say, belief, but also your action? 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. No matter where you are on this issue, I'd love to hear how that first film, 2006, An Inconvenient Truth, and then, you know, whether you intend to see the sequel here, what your thoughts are about that, and if it's moved you at all. Now, Susan Spencer, let's see here, 2006, so it's 8 years later you're in Australia with Al Gore, but did you see An Inconvenient Truth? I mean, it was a different time in your life.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
And I still haven't.
You still haven't?
No.
I'm surprised at that. Okay.
I know.
So So what brought you to Australia? Take our listeners through what happened and that whole process.
It's a funny story, actually. I went to go see Neil deGrasse Tyson speak at MCC, and I was able to ask him a question, and I rambled on about what my thesis was. I won't go into it here. And he stopped me, and he said, well, you make leaves. And I asked him, well, then how do I communicate science better? This is really important to me, that people understand science and that they understand the meaningfulness of it and how it works. And he said, follow people on Twitter that are already doing it. So I followed Al Gore on Twitter, and I filled out an application to go and be trained, and I was accepted. And it all happened in a very short span of time. I was finishing up my PhD thesis, so a trip to Australia was a bit weird to fit in there. But then I went for a 4-day training seminar.
How much of Al Gore himself did you experience there?
There was eight hours of full-on Al Gore. and that was where, you know, he went through the slide deck for the climate reality leaders, everyone who was there. I think there were about 500 people from, 54 countries, and essentially talked us through all of the information that was in the slide deck, which was essentially the Inconvenient Truth movie. So I don't feel I need to see it because I've seen the slides.
Yeah.
So he taught us about the slides, and then, you know, the rest of the time was kind of training us on how to actually communicate science effectively, how to talk about what this data is, what it means, and what is debatable and what is not.
Interestingly, Alan Alda may be doing that more effectively now with his organization that's aimed at helping communicate science a little bit better because he doesn't come with that hyper-political charge. Al Gore is trying to get you to communicate and your colleagues science more effectively, but just the patina of Al Gore may make it hard for people to bring that message in. So now, this film, mm-hmm. you know, and I recognize for listeners, this is unfair probably to any political leader. It's probably unfair to Al Gore because if they're doing it for the reasons they think are, I don't know if anybody has anything for true altruism, but if whatever your reason is, if they're spreading a message about climate change and climate urgency, I don't think it's necessarily fair to kind of come down on them for that. But what do you think about his centrality coming back here into the climate conversation, Susan?
Well, the reality is Mr. Gore has never left. He's just been doing things that don't create celebrity or renown.
Okay.
I find it problematic when we as a nation or as a global species look to the famous or look to the celebrity as the be-all, end-all authority on this. I think that the work that Mr. Gore does in educating world leaders and in educating average people like myself is incredibly important. I don't think this movie is about that.
Yeah, the New Yorker review of the film was, it wasn't all that complimentary. It was a little critical on two fronts. One being that the film was a lot about Al Gore and his work, and that it wasn't really about common solutions to climate change. In a second, I'm going to bring Seamus back in because I think that that is so important here, that whether you believe it or not, are you doing things that indicate that we are going to adapt or not? But the New Yorker is saying the film doesn't really give you that, very much of that, that it's more about sort of the big picture, international, behind the scenes wheelings and dealings and Al Gore's place in that. And, you know, it's hard. I haven't seen it yet.
And of course, I haven't either. But I think it's really critical that in this time, in this moment, we just pause and recognize that we are past the tipping point for the increase in global temperature. So what we need to be focusing on is mitigation and adaptation. And I think anyone who is not on message with that is detracting from the work of those deeply involved in the climate crisis, whether it's front lines with the farmers or front lines with island nations that are losing their land, mm-hmm. Or, you know, the pipeline protesters. You know, it's the actual people that are doing the work where our focus needs to be. Leadership is not the sole purview of the famous, and we have to stop looking to the famous as the only sources for leadership on this issue.
All right, let me turn back to Seamus McGraw, the author of Betting the Farm on a Drought, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change. So we'll talk about that adaptation in a second, Seamus, but in the big picture, do you find yourself wishing that it wasn't Al Gore back in this conversation, or, you know, do you view him as a net negative or positive?
Do I find myself wishing that it wasn't Al Gore back in this conversation? No, I don't find myself wishing that at all. But Al Gore plays to a very specific narrative. Al Gore in this film, basically he reinforces a narrative for people who already accept the narrative. We were just talking a moment ago about the ideas of to rise to the challenge, getting beyond the power of celebrity or the power of the powerful, and really changing the narrative, because that is the thing that is absolutely, I believe, first and foremost, the fundamental building block for any action. And it does come in terms of adaptation and mitigation. When you look at what David Ford is doing on his farm in Dumas, Texas, or you look at what Joe Leathers was doing in the book, the rancher who moved all the cattle off of 4-6's ranches a few years ago to allow the land to turn around and come back. Or you look at what Ethan Cox is doing, the farmer for whom the book is titled, who turned around and changed his approach in order to turn around and get around a looming drought that he saw when nobody else saw coming. These are all examples of, to a very great extent, adaptation and mitigation. They don't call it that. They call it farming. They call it fishing. They call it ranching. And if we're going to turn around and rise to the challenge that we're facing, and I do believe it is an existential challenge, one of the things we're going to have to do is change the narrative and make it less about these forceful individual personalities, be they celebrities or political officials or former political officials, and more about the individual stories of people who are rising to the challenge on a day-to-day basis. Those are the stories that get beyond, I think, the barricades. Those are the stories that get beyond the tribal identities. Those are the stories that talk about what are we doing in practical terms and what do we need to do in practical terms. Am I making any sense there?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I opened the hour by saying, you know, David Ford's story as a farmer was so interesting to me, because it kind of doesn't matter if he wants to say that he believes in climate change, because his actions indicate that he is going to deal with it one way or another, right?
Exactly, Evan. I have a guiding philosophy that covers both my theology and my action on this stuff, and it's that I don't care. I don't care for a moment what you believe. I care what you do. Mm-hmm. And what these people are doing is what they've always done, but they're doing it in the face of a different challenge. And there's so much that we can learn from what these people are doing. There is so much we can learn from what Ethan Cox in Illinois did to turn around and mitigate the impacts, adapt to and mitigate the impacts of an historic cycle of drought and flooding. It's exactly what our scientists tell us we should be doing. But we don't hear these voices because, frankly, they're obscured by the people who purport to speak for us.
So, and by the way, listeners, we're talking to Seamus McGraw, the author of the book that I think it would be a wonderful read for you if you really want to understand what adaptation truly means. This goes way beyond the jargon, and it takes you to the front lines of climate change. That's the name of the book, Betting the Farm on a Drought, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change. And the author is on with us. And Seamus, I'm curious to know how you would kind of break this down. So you talked to a number of farmers, a number of people in the quote-unquote American heartland or whatever you want to call it. And I'm wondering, you know, what percentage would you guess would say that they believe in climate change? And then what percentage is so obstinate that they don't, that they aren't doing any adaptation or mitigation? Because my guess is just about everybody is doing some kind of adaptation or mitigation.
Well, yeah, and that's the point. I mean, if you're not doing it, if at this stage of the game, you're in southern Illinois and you're not adapting, you're out of business. If you're in West Texas, okay, now that the killer drought of 2012 on, that has passed. But you turn around and talk to a guy like Lyle Larson, who is the Republican chairman of the House Environment Committee in the legislature in Texas. Okay, not a person who belongs to a party that by and large recognizes climate change. He's out there on the front lines turning around talking about water and water issues, saying that, you know, we are, regardless of what you believe about climate change, we are almost certainly staring down the barrel in Texas and in the High Plains of a killer multi-year drought that is going to dwarf what we just saw in this last one. You add into that the factor of climate change, and you know what? If you're a farmer or you're a rancher or you're a fisherman off the coast of New Jersey, you can turn around and say it at a political rally or, you know, with the mailings that come in your mailbox, anything you like about the issue of climate change. But if you intend to stay in business, you know in your heart that you're going to turn around and have to make changes. What you fish, what you farm, how you fish it, how you farm it. You're going to have to make those changes. And the changes that are going to be made are going to affect just your future, but also your immediate bottom line. And they're going to do it by turning around and reducing fuel consumption. They're going to do it by reducing the amounts and substance of certain chemicals that are used. All of these things are going to make unbalanced progressive changes, which leads me back to the point that I made earlier, which is I don't care what you believe. I care what. And if you want to survive in the business, and the business that your father was in, the business that your grandfather was in, you're going to have to adapt. And here's the other thing. Those of us who are beyond persuaded about the reality of the challenge that we face, we have to stop turning around and marginalizing and ignoring those people, because these people are doing the cutting-edge work that we're going to need to emulate on a larger scale in order to achieve the kind of mitigation efforts, in order to achieve the kind of adaptation efforts that we're going to need to achieve.
Now,
often don't hear them because of our political and cultural biases, and also because mechanisms hardly exist for their stories to be told.
So, Seamus, I want to follow up on that point with you, and then ask our guests to also weigh in on this because, and by the way, we're getting quite varied feedback from listeners in a lot of platforms. So we'll get to your phone calls, tweets, and emails in our second half hour. I also want to thank a listener named Harry for who's always one step ahead of me. Thank you, Harry, for reminding me that I should remind our listeners that Gore's new film, An Inconvenient Sequel, hits the Little Theater starting Friday. So you can start Friday at the Little Theater, which was where you should be going for all of your film watching anyway. But anyway, so Seamus, let me follow with you, and then I'll ask our guests in studio this. What you're describing is in some ways very encouraging for people concerned about climate change, because it goes beyond the politics. It doesn't matter if you say you believe in it or not. The people on the front lines are doing what they need to do to try to adapt to it. Here's the concern. For the people who are not on the quote-unquote front lines, for the people in Washington, for the people in policy debates, for the people in suburbs, for the people maybe here in Rochester, that don't see that sharply or that urgently, if you say you don't believe it, then you can affect policy that may impact the front lines, or they may impact consumption or energy usage, etc. In other words, if you're on the front lines, it doesn't matter what you say. You see it, you have to react to it and believe it. If you're not, you can still have power, but it's not going to hit you as hard, and that dogma might be harder to move off of. Does that make sense?
I think it makes sense, but I think to a very great extent, one thing that needs to be recognized is that political power doesn't lead, it follows. And the reality is, when you turn around and talk about in the last couple of elections, some of the most influential districts in this country, the ones that have tipped elections one way or the other, are those very sparsely populated rural communities, are those very very sparsely populated rural areas. It is very, very easy for a handful of people to impact the debate. But it requires a hands-on kind of thing. Look, I think the biggest challenge, the biggest obstacle is not the distribution of population in suburbs and cities versus rural communities. Because to a very great extent, again, I'll use Texas as an example. You turn around and look at Texas, and you have the cities that are by and large becoming bluer, and therefore more responsive along the lines to the classic progressive response to climate, and rural communities that are becoming more aware of the stake they have in doing it, even if they don't call it climate. That's the beginning. That's the beginning of a building of a consensus. It takes time, and time is something we have in quite frankly, short supply.
Hmm.
But we're moving in that direction.
All right, Susan.
And I am optimistic.
Are you as optimistic, Susan?
I guess listening to Seamus makes me more optimistic, so maybe I should hang out with him more. I guess I'm optimistic because of the response that I see as I tailor my message. It's incredibly important for anyone working in this to meet people where they're at. So when I am speaking with people, I'm talking about the economics of renewable energy, the economics of it and what it can do for them. When I'm talking about energy efficiency, I'm talking about improvements to quality of life and health in the home. When I'm talking about urban farming as a way to solve food deserts, again, we're talking local, we're talking neighbors to neighbors, and we're talking about things that people can actually do. So I think, again, belief becomes irrelevant. And belief is always irrelevant in science. Mm-hmm. Science is about data. You can either accept or refute my data, but whether you believe it is not even a real question when you're speaking with a scientist.
It's irrelevant in every science except for political science.
I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole, but yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
and Linda, how do you feel? Are you as optimistic as Seamus is that there is something moving toward consensus, even if we feel so polarized?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think especially among young people. Young people make me really hopeful because I see a lot of people, of young people, concerned and taking action around climate change. One thing that you said earlier, though, Evan, that I want to address is you and Seamus talked about how people, regardless of their belief, are acting, the farmers being perfect examples, and how they're protecting themselves against the effects of climate change. And I think that's important, and absolutely more and more people will continue to do that, even here in Rochester, where we're not on the front lines. We are taking action. We just had the bike share program come in, and the city passed their climate action plan, and we're looking at the efficiency of housing stock and so much more. But I think it's really important not to just react to the effects, because as we all know, the science said, the effects are already in the pipeline. And so it's really important to also reduce emissions to try and prevent the worst effects.
And I think, Linda, this is a really hard problem for humankind, because humankind has been amazing at responding to challenges and rising above it. And this may be the first and greatest where that would not be good enough long term. So I take the point that Linda's raising there. I'm late for our only break of the hour. Let's get that break. We'll come back to your phone calls. So if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI. Those are all call letters still, right, Rob? 263-9994. Maybe you're listening on WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. Wherever you are, thanks for being here. We'll get those phone calls in next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Friday, the Little Theater is starting its run of an Inconvenient sequel, Al Gore's sequel film to his 2006 film, the documentary An Inconvenient Truth. And we're talking about the impact of Gore and his work in the public sphere. And we're also talking a little bit about, let's get wonky, epistemology, how we form beliefs, how we communicate with each other, and then whether that matters when it comes to action. Our guest in studio, Susan Spencer, who is the president of Rockspot. And Rockspot, by the way, is what?
Rockspot is a solar advocacy company that focuses on education, community engagement, and risk mitigation.
And in 2014, Susan was one of, as I recall, a couple hundred maybe? How many from around the world went to Al Gore's Australia summit in 2014?
I think there were over 500. Okay. I was the only one from the U.S., though.
Only one from the U.S.
Yep.
In 2014 to attend. Linda Isaacson-Fidelli, a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Seamus McGraw on the phone with us. He's the author of Betting the Farm on a Drought, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change. Let me read a couple comments from Twitter, and then we'll get to your phone calls. Here, this kind of represents the mix of response. Benjamin writes to us and says, "This discussion simply sounds like an admission for the lack of critical thinking that permeates our country." So maybe a little pessimism. Ben writes to us and says, a different Ben, this is Ben Deitchman, he says, "Gore's film is going to be positive if the focus remains on climate change. It's distracting if the public conversation becomes about Hillary, Bernie, and the future of the Democratic Party." Josh says, "Partisanship is so toxic that nothing outside of their own outlets trumpeting climate change as a major problem will alter things." In other words, Al Gore is not going to change anybody's mind one way or another, though I think Linda made the point earlier that it might galvanize more actual action on the side, the quote-unquote side that Gore is on. So that's a little bit of listener feedback, and let me get your phone calls. Jane in Rochester first. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes. Evan, it's kind of confusing to me because we have climate change, but we've had the environmental catastrophes for quite a while, and those two overlap. So if the ice caps weren't melting, we'd still be in big trouble because of all the pollution and oil spills, or, you know, BP in the Gulf. I mean, we have those kinds of things that come together and cause a lot of problems. So how do you differentiate climate change from the environment? And I want to say about Al Gore, I trust him so much because he's out there out front. He's well-versed in so many issues. He writes way above my head. And he has that very precious thing to me of credibility and the fact that he's not in elective office. What more do you want? The man's out there trying to, from his point of view, and I agree with him, to do some good by raising awareness.
But Jane,
who else would you believe better? And I've got some more to say that I want to say. it's very large in that how would we make a lot of decisions nationally. We always think of the moonshot in World War II. There was a national call to action. This is serious. And while I think you can do it on the local levels also, we're going to have a thing with shared sacrifices. And that's where the political problems could come in, I think. But don't you think these people would be more likely to believe it now that the ice caps actually are pretty much melted?
Well, Jane, let me just ask you one question, then our guest can respond. And my question is this. Do you have any friends or family who don't view Al Gore with the same admiration that you have for him?
Friends or family? Well, my family, they're right-wing radical Republicans. That's my family.
All right, so if you want your family to share your concern about climate change, what would they say if you said, look, listen to Al Gore. He is a competent voice. He's a leader in the field.
Look, we feel differently about that. I would not waste my time on my family. They're just beyond the pale. I don't know how to explain how hardcore they would be on so many different issues. That just being one, they're into that religiosity kind of thing, and very, very rigid in their thinking. They're not readers. They're not intellectual. They already know everything.
Well,
so I wouldn't waste my time on that.
Well, Jane, thank you, as always, for the phone call. In studio, let me ask our guest in studio, and then I've got specific questions for Seamus based on the first part of Jane's comments there. But Susan and Linda, she's saying she's kind of given up on her family there, and I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, I can understand it. I've got family members that I'd probably rather not speak to on this subject. But I think what it comes down to, she mentioned two things, radical Republican, which I'm not going to give a title to. But let's say people who are not going to be driven by the environment. And then she talked about very religious individuals. So in both of those groups, someone not driven by the environment will be driven by the economy. That's the conversation you need to have. It's all about the economics then. And when it comes to people who are very religious, every single major world religion has a philosophy of stewardship of the creation. And when that philosophy is appealed to, I've never had a bad discussion. Because what it comes down to is, if folks believe that God made the planet for us and put us here to take care of it, well, we better start taking care of it then. And here's some ways that we can do it.
Okay, and Linda, here's Terry on Twitter. Absolutely serious tweet, right? Just came in. Anything Gore says I'm against, he's a hypocrite.
So again, we glorify some people, we demonize others. I understand that a lot of people point to Gore's use of resources, shall we say, as being hypocritical. And I guess I would just say, you know, we have this myth in our country that we can solve everything as rugged individualists, that by purchasing the right thing or not doing the wrong thing, we can make a big difference. And yes, that's true if 100% of us did that. But given the choices that we have, it's just not possible. And that's why we need to be hammering at it, both from the individual level to the extent that folks are going to do that, and at the societal, governmental level to increase the number of green choices that we have.
Seamus McGraw, when you were out there working on your book, Betting the Farm on a Drought, you know, you're in Texas, you're in southern Illinois, you're talking to farmers. Some of our listeners might be saying, well, hey, how do you know that the drought you're describing or the challenges they're facing are climate related? I mean, how directly do you tie that, and can we reliably tie that?
I think two things. I think you can turn around and make the argument, and John Nielsen Gammon goes into this a little bit. You can make the argument that these are parts of natural cycles. In Texas, for example, there is a persistent and historic cycle of droughts. It is also pretty much undeniable at this point that the circumstances that contribute to those droughts are accelerating, that the droughts are coming closer together, and that they're becoming more severe. This is, at this stage of the game, the distinction between what portion of it is driven by a changing climate and what portion of it is the conditions we've always faced, made worse not just by the changing climate, but by the number of people who are now in harm's way. You know, when you had the drought of record in Texas in the 1950s, the one that Elmer Kelton wrote about in The Time It Never Rained, a crippling, devastating drought, it was considered to be as bad as it could get. This last drought was, in some areas, worse, deeper, and in some cases almost as prolonged. There is little doubt among the people that study these things that in the very near future, and it seems to happen on 85-year cycles, a drought as bad as the drought of record is going to repeat, and that it's going to be augmented. At that stage of the game, when you're facing that kind of threat, which is really an existential threat, with that many more people who are potentially affected by it, I mean, you're talking about 15, 20 more people who are potentially in harm's way from that kind of a augmented natural cycle. The idea of getting into a pitched argument with the guy on the street about how much of it is climate and how much of it is natural is kind of a waste of time, isn't it? I mean, the reality is you've got a loaded gun pointed at your head, okay? Don't ask to see a receipt for the gun. Deal with the gun.
Susan Spencer, you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, Seamus's point, I think, is incredibly important to make, and that is cycles exist all over the planet. One of the biggest ones is the hydrological cycle, the water cycle, and it is very simple. Water is in the sea, it evaporates, and then it precipitates, and then it goes back over and over and over again. So yes, these cycles are natural. There are drought cycles, there are monsoons, but with a cycle, when you add energy to it, and in this case, mm-hmm. it's energy in the form of heat, you accelerate it and you make it lopsided in many areas. You imbalance the cycle by the injection of the heat. I was speaking today with teachers about how to talk to kids about this. And I said, if you have a campfire and you're holding a cold marshmallow and then you put the marshmallow over the campfire, what happens? The marshmallow changes and it absorbs the heat. That's exactly the same thing that's happening with these cycles. You know, the air can hold more water as it gets warmer. So we're going to have more evaporation, which causes drought, and more precipitation, which causes floods. It can be explained simply, but again, to Seamus's point, if we're dealing with a loaded gun, sometimes you don't want to bother.
Okay. Dina on the line next up. Go ahead, Dina.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to hear Susan Spencer speak one day, and the film really disturbed me. So the next day, I applied for some money for my 401. And I now have solar panels on my home, and it's not going to solve everything, but it's what I can do with the little bit of money I make. I've been in the same field for 17 years, and I don't even make $13 an hour. But I had this money saved, and it was important to me, and I'm so grateful for everything Susan Spencer does. And everybody loves my solar panels on my street, yet no one else is getting any. It just makes me feel like I'm doing what I can. That's all.
Thank you, Dina, for the phone call. Susan?
I thank you very much for that. You are an early adopter, and I think that that is absolutely amazing. What we see when solar goes into neighborhoods is that it takes time for the neighbors to really start to wonder, gosh, maybe she did that and is making money now. But you are the beginning of a seed crystal, and what you have done is so important, and it is so meaningful. As we see things like solar or smart grids or small wind or small hydro being deployed more and more across the country, those actual tangible objects are, again, they are part of the front line. So Dina is on our front lines here in Rochester. She's out there doing the hard work. And thank you so much for doing it, and thank you so much for your kind words.
All right, back to the phones. Keith, next up. Go ahead, Keith.
I have some friends and who were, they maybe for lack of common sense, they sort of like argue. But what I try to do is dumb down the science. Just basically say, if you have a pound of coal and you burn it, as the carbon joins with the oxygen, it gives off heat and creates carbon dioxide. And you have a little ash. And I say the reason why you do this, because you cannot create matter and you cannot destroy matter. You can only change it. So how much, and then I explain to him, I say, how much coal have we burned in the last 300-400 years? I mean, millions and millions and millions of tons. So what happens to the carbon dioxide? It goes up in the air. Now, then I go on to explain to him, the only way you can get rid of the carbon dioxide is with plants. The plants absorb the carbon dioxide, keep the carbon, give off the oxygen. But all that's doing it is maintaining it into a different form, because when the plants die, it releases the carbon dioxide all over again. Have they changed their minds? I don't know, but that's as simple as I can explain it to them.
Okay, but you're not seeing any change, Keith? I mean, you're saying it doesn't sound like you think it's...
Well, I'll see change when their well runs out of water, or if it's 65 degrees in the middle of January. I don't think, they're older. They're probably not going to see, islands totally overwhelmed by ocean water. Their children or their grandchildren might, but the problem... People are pretty stupid. They're easily led, and then you throw in politics behind it, and then you throw in religion behind it, and for lack of a better word, we're screwed. You just cannot get by those two things and try to approach it from a common scientific sense of purpose.
That is an optimistic way to end that phone call. Thank you, Keith. Seamus, before I've got a guy on the line who's used to be a crop duster and wants to talk about farming challenges. I'm going to go to him next. But Seamus, you want to weigh in at all on what Keith is saying in terms of, because part of the message from author Seamus McGraw, who's been on the line with us this hour, is that it and the front lines, especially in farming communities, it kind of doesn't matter. They are adapting. They are facing it. They're dealing with the change. And they, it doesn't matter what they tell you they think. But Seamus, Keith kind of sounds like he's frustrated that with all of the evidence we have in front of us, that we still have that obstinance. And then
there are two things I would like to address from what Keith had to say. The first is I bristle, okay, when I hear people talk about religion and politics necessarily fostering stupidity. At my farm, I have a number of friends who are devout, very fundamentalist Christians. And they honestly do believe that the world is 5,570 years old or whatever. And my friends from the city will come up and mock them. How could you possibly be that stupid? And I'll always point out to them that, you know what? That guy may think that the land is only 570 years old, but he knows how it works a hell of a lot better than you do. And he's in a better position to respond to it. Right now, there is no question that the things that are meant to bring us together, like politics, like religion, have often been used to divide us. But there are also voices out there, like Catherine Hayhoe, One of the authors of the IPCC 2007 report, a very, very, very capable, very, very, very involved climate scientist who also happens to be an evangelical Christian, who when she talks about what the science tells her, she says, you know, it's like looking at God's lab notes. And I guess the point that I would make to what Keith had to say is that it's very, very easy to turn around and see these things as obstacles. It's harder. It takes more character, more understanding, more patience to understand how those are also an opportunity.
Well said. Let me grab one more phone call. Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Two things. One, there's a wonderful TED Talk about science where the woman that gives the talk says science takes a long time, and if you look at things that change the paradigm, like the fact that the Earth is not the center of the universe, and Madame Curie discovering her discovery took a long time, and it took a lot of other scientists verifying. So it's not a specific one scientist says this that it becomes fact. It takes years for things to become fact and take a lot of convincing. And my experience as a crop duster was I was in the Southern Tier for about 7 years spraying potatoes. And when I first started, we used terribly toxic chemicals. When I stopped, they had changed a lot of the chemicals that were not nearly as toxic. And the other thing that was very encouraging is that the Cornell Ag School stepped up to the plate. And when I first started, we would spray every 7 days for a particular fungus. And the Cornell University came up with this plan of a small microprocessor that would sit in the middle of a farmer's field, keep track of the sunshine and the moisture and the temperature, and say, no, you don't have to spray right this every 7 days. You can wait 10 and then 15 and then 20 days. So they changed the nature of the amount of chemicals we were putting on the crops. And they also changed the farmer's thinking. For instance, we used to spray a lot of insecticides. So Cornell took the undergraduate students, gave them a job for the summer, and say, today you walk through the farmer's field and you take a survey of how many potato bugs you see. And up to a certain point, you don't spray. So they reduced the spray. And this was people who, you know, deal with farmers on a regular level. And farmers are pretty conservative in a lot of ways because they got a lot of investment sitting in the ground. And I quit in 85, and I'm very encouraged by things that the way they changed then and continue to change. So
yeah, Eric, and I just got to jump in. Thank you so much because we're going to lose the hour here. But Seamus, we're down to the last 30 seconds. He's talking about farming. Some quick final thoughts based on his call and the book.
Well, I think he's hit exactly what is really, frankly, one of the underlying themes of the book, and that is the idea that what we are talking about is farming in the Anthropocene. And what you're doing is you're talking about the fact that we have made, even in the 2.5 decades since he retired, we have made tremendous strides in being able to turn around and focus things like irrigation, focus things like planting, focus things like how and what and when and where things are planted, focused in terms of how we bunch plants together, and focused in terms of how we turn around and apply and don't apply various chemicals. We continue to make progress on those sorts of things, and that progress is not coming from the top down. It's easy to turn around and imagine that it's all Monsanto. It's not. It's the feedback from guys like David Ford and the folks in Southern Illinois. It's the feedback. It's what they're seeing and what they're experimenting with and what they're demanding that's little by little changing that. And we are fortunate to some degree that this crisis happened at the same time the tremendous technological advancements in terms of communication and data happened.
And Seamus, let me just jump in because we're going to lose you. But we had listeners saying, who is this guy? Well, his name's Seamus McGraw. The book is Betting the Farm on a Drought. Great having you, Seamus. Thank you so much.
Pleasure being here, and I'm sorry for the technical problem.
You got it. No problem. Susan Spencer from Rock Spot, Linda Isaacson, Fidelity. Great having you all. More Connections next.